live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And I'm Tim Lloyd.
And from St. Louis Public Radio,
this is We Live Here.
On this episode, crossing over the blue line, what it's like being a police officer.
Let's face it, as of late, the national spotlight has shined on police and their practices.
So we wanted to know, what's it like being a police officer? What does it take to become a cop, average salaries, residency requirements?
And finding all that information, let's be honest, sounds like a lot of work to both of us, I think.
Yeah, so we just asked someone else to do it. We asked Tom McClure. He's our Coro Fellow. Say hello,
hello,
Tom.
My name is Tom McClure. I'm a Coro Fellow here with Public Radio for the month.
Yeah, and what is a Coro Fellow?
Yeah, a Coro Fellow, it's a public affairs fellowship where we rotate through different placements over the course of a year doing policy research, and that's what I'm doing here.
And you got hooked up with Public Radio.
That's right.
And you like it. You love it, actually.
I love it.
You love it.
Yep.
All right. So we asked Tom to gather a bunch of different information for us about police, some numbers, some kind of just more general questions. And one of them we wanted to know is, you know, what does it take to become a police officer in Missouri? So, yeah, what does it take?
Yeah, so as most people probably know, to become an officer, you have to go to police academy. So there are 19 police academies in the state of Missouri. Two of them are actually here in St. Louis. One's with the county department and the other is with the city department. And you apply to get into the police academy. And once you've graduated from the academy, there's an exam that you have to take. It's administered by the Peace Officers Standards and Training Commission, which is a part of the Department of Public Safety for the state. And they basically have a 200-question test that tests you on four different categories, legal studies, interpersonal skills, technical questions, and then skills-based questions.
And you took a sample exam, right?
Yeah. So they actually put out like a user guide for people that are taking the test, trying to prepare on the website. And at the end of that guide, they have 9 sample questions that they say are representative of the kinds of questions that you get asked on the actual exam. They have like one question for each of the different categories.
Yeah, and give me some specifics of the type of questions that were on that sample exam.
Yeah, there was a question about you know, what you need to have to get a search warrant. You know, what if someone's resisting arrest? What do you do with the handcuffs? Just procedural things like that.
You did okay.
Yeah, I actually got 7 out of the 9 questions correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So besides asking you to take a test, we also asked you to gather a bunch of information. We didn't just want information about, you know, the city and the county. We wanted information for all the wonderful little municipalities around St. Louis, all of their departments. So how'd that go?
Yeah, so there are actually 60 police departments, the county department, the city department, and then 58 municipal departments. And I tried to get information on all of them. I basically went to, you know, the websites for the departments. I called the departments, tried to figure out who to get my questions to. I actually asked 5 questions. So the first question I asked was, what are the different demographics of the department along gender and racial lines? And then how many of the officers live actually within the jurisdiction that they work? What the average education attainment level is for the officers? How many of the officers work a second job, and then how many of the officers have worked in a different department before coming to that one?
You know, I know from myself, my own experience, that, you know, sometimes you put out these Freedom of Information requests or Sunshine Law requests or whatever. You ask for information from government organizations, departments, and they want money in exchange for providing you that information. Did you have that experience?
I did, yeah. I mean, not with all of them. Some of them were, you know, very compliant, gave me the information right away. It really just depends on the size of the department and their familiarity with getting these kinds of requests, because some of them are really small and they've never gotten a request like this before. But yeah, so some of the departments would try to charge, you know, $12 an hour for clerks' work to pull the information together. And depending on how many, you know, personnel files they have to pull, it could
be a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the county was what?
How the much county was about $2,500 for the questions that I asked.
Gotcha. All right, so let's get into some of the stuff that you found. So let's roll through demographic data, for instance.
Yeah, so of the responses that we got, 14% of the officers were minority, 10% African-American, 7% female. Basically the breakdown there.
So male and white.
Yeah.
Mainly what? Police officers are. We also asked you for salary information for these different departments. So give us the gamut, highs, lows, average, all that stuff.
So for officers, which does not include captains, lieutenants, and police chief, the average officer salary was $48,800 a year. Mm-hmm. And the median was $48,300, so they were close together.
Mm-hmm. And high-low on that range?
Yeah. The highest was Brentwood, which was $70,000 a year, and the lowest was Velda City, $26,000. And there were sort of clusters at both of those different poles.
Yeah. That's a pretty big range.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. All right, so what about residency requirements? Because we're going to talk later in the show about this whole concept of community policing, getting to know the folks you're out there policing. How many officers live in the municipalities that they police?
Yeah, so for the responses that we got, it was about 5%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how many have residency requirements?
Yeah, so there are 60 departments, as I said. 15 of those require their officers to live in the state of Missouri. 25%. 9 of the departments have a regional requirement. Either it's that they require their officers to live within an hour's drive or 30 miles. One of the departments, the city, has the residency requirement that it requires their officers to live within the city for the first 7 years of their employment there. And then 35 of the departments, 58%, had no residency requirement at all.
Another thing we wanted to know about is, you know, how police officers move through these different departments.
Yeah.
What kind of information did you find about that path?
So the departments, I asked that question, you know, how many of your officers have worked at a different department before moving to this one? And they didn't have as concrete of numbers on that. But I did talk to a professor at SLU's Law School, actually, Roger Goldman, who is sort of an expert on this what he calls the Muni Shuffle. In St. Louis, where officers can, you know, pretty much just jump from department to department, over the course of their career because there are so many and they're all so close.
Right. And I assume they'd want to get up the salary ladder.
Yeah, exactly. If there's 26 to 70,000, exactly. It makes sense.
Right. Yeah. And so from the responses I got, the overwhelming average was about one department beforehand. So most of the officers had worked at a different department before coming mm-hmm. to their current one.
So we're actually going to go on a ride along with the cop in this episode, and that officer is from Maplewood. So just give us all the Maplewood things as a nice little introduction.
Yeah, so the demographics of the officers, there's 4 African-American officers, 1 Asian-American, and 1 Hispanic-American, so they're 18% minority and 11.7% African-American. And the actual African-American population of Maplewood is 17%. And then as far as salary goes, the average is $66,000 for an officer, which is on the high end.
Yeah, that's pretty good money.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, Tom, thank you so much for your time and getting all this information for us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Yep.
All right, let's go on a ride-along.
That's coming up right after this. That's the sound of a dispatcher sending out a message to Erica Estes. She's an officer with the Maplewood Police Department.
And recently, St. Louis Public Radio's Stephanie Lecce got to spend some time with Estes while she was working her beat. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about that. What was it like?
It was great. Officer Estes just joined Maplewood in June, but before that, she'd spent 12 years with the Richmond Heights Police.
Why'd she make the move?
Well, she said it was for a variety of reasons, but like Tom was talking about before, there was a bump in pay.
Of course, yeah.
Now, she didn't say exactly how much she's making now, but the average salary in Richmond Heights is around $59,000 a year. And again, Maplewood pays officers on average about $66,000 a year. And she had mentioned that for a couple of years, she was working a secondary job while at Richmond Heights at a bowling alley.
So was she okay with you riding along in the car with her? How was that?
Actually, she told me she didn't know why her superiors chose her for the extended interview, and she expressed some concern about revealing too many personal details. Just for an example, her supervisors were fine with me taking photos, but she was uneasy about having her face on our website, mostly out of what she says are safety concerns.
All right, so she's a little bit anxious at first, but did she start to kind of warm up to you after a while?
Oh, yeah, pretty quickly. I mean, almost as soon as we started the ride along at 8 in the morning. But right off the bat, she did give me some instructions.
Try to know where we are at all times in case an emergency happens or something where I can't get to my radio, something like that. Okay. Just kind of be aware of your surroundings. And if some emergency does happen, this orange button right here, just push that.
Okay.
So there's GPS in the car. They'll know where everyone's at, all that good stuff.
All right.
Okay?
Sounds great. The car is a standard police vehicle with a grate separating the front and back seats, but a little more snug than I expected.
This is our video camera that's in the car, so all our traffic stops are recorded. This is our computer where we run license plates and do all that good stuff on here. These are just all the lights and sirens and the intercom.
All that equipment makes a lot of noise as we cruise the bumpy roads of Maplewood's 1.5 square miles on a continuous loop. And we made that loop many, many, many times. But as we drive, Estes keeps her eyes peeled for traffic violations.
You looking up this car? Oh, yeah, I have a taillight out.
She begins typing the license plate number into her laptop computer.
This is our computer system where we can run all the license plates through. A lot of times you can just, you just run a license plate and see what comes up. If it has a warrant attached to it or if the plate's not registered to that car. You know, in the state of Missouri, there's no expectation of privacy on a license plate.
Which means checking a license plate could lead a police officer to find out about other violations. In this case, the car was properly registered, so she doesn't pull the driver over. But if there had been a warrant for the driver's arrest, Estes would have taken the person to jail. For Maplewood, that means over to Richmond Heights. Or if the driver lacked a license or proper insurance.
I usually don't do warnings.
Estes says she'd issue one or two citations per person. She says she's not thinking about generating revenue for Maplewood. She's simply enforcing the city's laws.
I try not to issue more than 3 or 4 citations because at some point it can become a revolving door for them if, you know, financial reasons are some of the reasons. Maybe their license plates aren't up to date or they can't have all their equipment up to code on their vehicle. Well, I may decide, to only issue 1, 2, 3 violations as opposed to, citing them for all 8 or however they may have.
Hold on just a sec. So sorry to break in here, Stephanie.
That's okay. What's up?
Well, we just want to emphasize that the way municipalities issue citations has come under a lot of scrutiny lately.
And a quick programming note that in later shows, we'll get into how these citations and other minor violations can have big consequences for poor people.
Well, those citations are really up to the discretion of officers like Estes to decide if they'll even write a ticket in the first place.
So did she write a lot of tickets?
Well, when I was with her, she didn't write any.
Okay. All right.
So are we good here?
Yeah, I think so.
We can go.
Great. So at this point, Estes is scanning the streets for anyone who needs help or anything out of the ordinary.
For instance, if, 2 in the morning, you see someone standing next to the side of a house, well, it could be a resident. You get out and talk to them. It could be a resident that's happy you stopped and checked on them to make sure it wasn't a burglary that was occurring. Or I've had it to where they get very upset with you and feel like you're, intruding on their life and their property.
She says sometimes that scrutiny bothers people.
Just sometimes people feel like they take it personal when you're targeting them, and you're not. You're investigating what's going on, and oftentimes nothing's going on, and we're both going our way.
But what looks out of the ordinary to me is totally normal for her. Take, for instance, the young woman we drive by walking barefoot down the sidewalk, wrapped in a blanket.
She was going into her apartment complex, so I'm actually familiar with her, so that's nothing out of the ordinary for her.
Estes says it's a matter of knowing the community she works in. She knows where the problem spots are and where mental health issues might come into play.
These apartments here are actually some apartments where a lot of people with mental illnesses are placed. It's called Maplewood Village. So a lot of our mental health crisis calls will be in these apartment complexes.
She also knows that getting out among residents, walking the business district, talking to store owners, listening to people's concerns, all that makes people more comfortable around police, although they don't always expect it.
There's a pet shop in one of the business districts there, and they had a corgi rescue group. So you had like 30 dogs with short little legs running around. It was darling. Really cute.
Adorable.
Yeah. So of course, being a dog lover, I couldn't resist. I had to get out, and of course, everyone thought that, I was there to, is somebody in trouble? I'm like, no, I just am a dog lover and I want to see these little guys.
Estes doesn't live in Maplewood, yet in her mind, she's still very much a part of the city. At least a half dozen people, kids, adults, black, white, wave at us as we drive along. But then again,
sometimes you'll see people flick you off in the rearview mirror like that guy just did.
Estes says that anger toward police has increased since the unrest in Ferguson last summer, and she feels criminals have become more brazen. But that doesn't mean people don't still call the police for help. In fact, one guy walks right up to our car after we pull into a gas station.
How you doing?
I had one of my guys run off with my blower.
The guy owns a lawn care company, and one of his recent employees seems to have made off with an expensive leaf blower. Estes gets on her computer and finds out the alleged thief doesn't live in Maplewood, so another police department will have jurisdiction. And remember, between St. Louis City and County, there are 60 different police departments.
Now, it literally, Richmond Heights and St. Louis City split that street.
That's nice.
So what I would do is go to Richmond Heights and see if they can accompany you down there, or okay, go down there themselves and get it, okay?
I ask Estes if it's frustrating to not be able to help someone because a crime happens just a couple of blocks over, outside of Maplewood's jurisdiction.
You know, it is frustrating for the people who are trying to report something and you're sending them to different jurisdictions because there are so many municipalities within the St. Louis area. I think they can often feel like they're being bounced around and no one really wants to help, so that's why it's important to get them in the direction, point them in the direction they need to go, and tell them specifically what they need to do and who they need to talk to.
And Leaf Blower Guy is just the beginning. A call comes in for a woman concerned her house was being broken into. A resident's dog is on the loose. There's a loud house party. But I'm not gonna lie, the calls are a little boring.
Some days the boredom kills me, and other days I kill to be bored.
Still, she kind of likes not knowing what might happen next. Then again, Estes says that uncertainty can be pretty scary.
You don't want to be complacent. You want to remember that you can get injured in this job and you can get hurt. And that's why you always need to try to be on top of your game. And it's a tough job to do. You often have, you know, a split second to make a decision that can drastically change your life or someone else's.
Her family worries about her safety too, particularly her mom, who's been texting her throughout the day.
Did you ever get back to your mom? Yes. I have to respond to my mom.
Clearly, family is important to Estes. After all, it was her brother, a former cop himself, who got her interested in law enforcement. Now, she couldn't imagine doing anything else. She says she puts her whole heart into the job and holds herself to a high ethical standard. She enjoys solving investigations and helping people, like when Maplewood police solved the case of a 14-year-old kid who was robbed at gunpoint and assaulted while walking home from school to his grandmother's house.
He was a good kid. He didn't deserve that. And it was nice to be able to solve that and let him know, hey, we did get the guys who did this to you, and the justice system is dealing with it.
We return to the police department around 3:30 in the afternoon, so Estes can get to work finishing up some reports from her last shift. As we say our goodbyes, I realize I have a new appreciation for the sheer unpredictability of police work. You never know what kinds of calls you'll get or what'll happen when you get there. Estes says she wishes more people could understand her job.
If people could ride with us on a daily basis and see how we do interact and see all the different people we speak with, and the people that we do have great interactions with, I think they would really feel differently.
So we just heard a little bit about what it's like being a cop from our officer in Maplewood, but we wanted to add another element to that, and that element is race.
Right. So we asked Rachel Lippman, who is St. Louis Public Radio's criminal justice reporter, to reach out to a black police officer to get their perspective. And of course, Rachel being Rachel, she did way more than what we asked her to do. She found a bunch of folks. So, Rachel, where should we start?
We're going to start with a gentleman named Morris Taylor. He's an associate professor at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville and a chair of the Department of Public Administration and Policy Analysis there. He's also a former St. Louis Metropolitan and St. Louis County police officer. And he grew up in the 1960s when relationships between blacks and police officers were, as he put it, it was an understatement to say that it was strained. He did have family connections to policing. He had a relative who was a railroad police officer, and he was inspired enough to start as a police cadet right out of high school, which was just kind of this one-month experience program, gave high school students a chance to see what life as a police officer could be like.
The first job I had was in the Communications Bureau, and where we dispatched police cars. And at that time, I was sort of idealistic. I'd watched Dragnet and Adam 12 on television. I thought this is the way officers were, until I got my first assignment in the academy, where the N-word was thrown around routinely as if it was just another part of your normal vernacular. But I think what really caught my attention early on was when I worked in communication. And being one of the only few African Americans in communication, I think there was one other African American cadet at that time. I remember an incident when I was learning to dispatch on the 6th and 8th District when they were combined at that time. And I can remember the person who was training me put out an all-points bulletin for a robbery in the 8th District. And he was talking fast, and he was a little bit excited because it was an urgent situation. But after he got the description of the perpetrator, who were African Americans, his all-points bulletin was, and I quote, because I'll never forget this, attempt to locate and arrest four niggers. That's what came out all points of the entire city because it was an emergency broadcast for robbery suspects. That caught my attention real quick. And the gentleman training me made no apology. I complained to the sergeant who was on duty that particular night, and it went nowhere. This type of thing was common. And I was a young person wanting to become a policeman at some point in time, and it just never, ever left me.
And so he's hearing, I mean,
that's
honestly,
awful stuff,
this awful stuff. I mean, did that deter him at all from going on and wanting to be an officer?
It soured him on the city department, quite obviously. He's sitting there thinking, if this is, you know, my supervisor, my trainer, this is how they're treating people like me, what's it going to be like if I join the force? But he did still want to become an officer. So when he was old enough, he entered the police academy. He had to be 21 and he was right out of high school. So he worked for a while in the private sector and then entered the police academy in January 1975. The city and the county trained together back then. So after he graduated, he joined the county department because he had heard that it was actually pretty well run, that they had a good chief in place who just had zero tolerance for any kind of ridiculousness. And he became the first black officer to patrol in Lima.
Right. And let's tell folks what, you know, about Lima, the demographics there.
Sure. Lima is this little area down in South St. Louis County. It was heavily white back then and is still very, very heavily white even now. And he says he'd be sitting in his police car writing reports. They didn't have computers. And he was approached several times by kids in the neighborhood. He said these were, you know, teenagers asking him if people like him, black people, really had tails. But he said,
Wait.
Yeah. Yeah. Just would walk up and be like, do you really have tails? But he said it wasn't anything like, it wasn't animosity. They were just kind of like curious because they'd never seen anyone like him, especially anyone in a position of power who was African American.
I handled a lot of calls down there. I stopped a lot of people. I made some arrests. It just never was an issue. And I think it was an issue because I wouldn't allow it to be an issue. And I think that's part of being a professional police officer.
All right, so he's the first black officer. He's hearing really some pretty awful stuff from kids when he's out patrolling in Lima. Where does his career go from here?
He actually stayed with the county for about 4 or 5 years, but the pay wasn't as great then. It was a newer department. So he decided, I'll go give the city a try again. And he lasted, he says, like 2 or 3 months.
Wow. What's up? Not very long at all. Yeah.
So when he joined the department, Morris Taylor was assigned to patrol the 3rd District, which is kind of down around Lafayette Square, down by the brewery, that sort of mid-south St. Louis area. And in the 1970s, you had the Darst-Webbe projects. It was a public housing project located just north of Lafayette Square near the old city hospital. The Clinton Peabody homes are over there now.
Mostly African-American.
Mostly African-American then and mostly African-American now. Officers that he rode with in the 3rd District would get assigned calls from the Communications Bureau, and they just would not respond at all. They just wouldn't go into the projects and respond to these calls.
The general reason was, it's just a disturbance, don't worry about it. But sometimes a disturbance later on could really sort of mushroom into a homicide or a shooting or a cutting or some other type of serious offense. So I never got a serious, in my view, honest reasons to why some officers would not respond, because some officers did respond.
What did you suspect were the reasons why these officers wouldn't take a call that they were basically being assigned to?
I would hate to think it was simply a matter of race. It could have been, but I have no evidence of that. I just think they were just very unprofessional police officers. It wasn't uncommon to see at times some officers drinking on duty, some officers not responding to calls, some officers visiting their girlfriends while they're on duty.
So drinking on
drinking on duty. Oh, okay. He would tell stories about them, you know, going down to the brewery and they'd hand him some beer. And
I guess things are different in the 70s. Hopefully they're different in the 70s. So he attributes this, you know, officer's refusal to check in on these disturbances, you know, is just, you know, a bunch of bad behaving police. Bad apples is a phrase I guess we throw around in that case a lot.
Yeah. Basically just this idea that boys behaving badly. And he says he was a little bit of a hothead back then and he had a really low tolerance for stuff like that. And that's why he lasted like 2 months at the city department when he went back.
So it sounds like Taylor is really making the case that even though clearly race is plays a role in how some of this policing took place when he was on the city force especially, but that really this also just boils down to simply unprofessional behavior.
I don't think he necessarily believes that racism wasn't at the root of it, but what his argument is that if you're a good cop, you can be professional no matter what you think about the person. That whatever your biases are, and all of us are biased at some level, if you're acting professionally, you're not going to let those biases come out in how you interact with people. And the second officer that I spoke to, that's kind of how he fundamentally goes about his job.
So who is this second officer?
His name is Gregory Santoni. He is a 10-year veteran of the St. Charles County Sheriff Police Department. This is a transition that happened in January from a sheriff's office to a police department. And he's also a military veteran.
So he's in St. Charles County. Tell us a little bit about that area. What's it like?
St. Charles County is west of St. Louis County. You cross the Missouri River, and that's basically where you are. And it's probably a little bit more diverse than it was when Santoni started back in 2005, but not really by much. Latest census data puts it at about 4% African-American. But Santoni said if he had any hesitation about taking the job in St. Charles County, he was familiar with it. He used to live in Alton, would come over to the county to swim on the beaches there. He says any hesitation he had wasn't about race at all.
Nope. And the reason is it's not because it's not a fact. It's not because, you know, there is or is not racism out here. It's just because it's just the fact that I know how to deal with people regardless of their race, creed, color, gender, sexual orientation, you know, what Jesus they pray to, whatever the case may be. That's the key. Because the key is that I can get along with anybody.
Santoni says he goes about his job the way that Morris Taylor wanted police officers to go about their job, just keeping it professional. He says he rolls up to every scene that he goes on the exact same way.
If you get out of the car, you know, like I said, with your chest all pumped out, thinking you're all that in a bag of chips, and that's how you talk, then of course they're going to get their own preconceived notion. Well, I don't want to talk to this guy's a butthole, you know, and then they might go racial. Oh, he's a butthole because he's black, or he's a butthole because, you know, he's Latino, or she's a butthole because, you know, she's female, whatever the case may be. But since I approach every scene the exact same way, I don't have any issues. I don't. I really don't. I mean, if I did, trust me, I would tell you.
So I guess we trust him. But, I mean, does he acknowledge that people carry around such a thing as implicit bias? You know, that there could be racial prejudice, whether you know it or not.
Sure, absolutely. Like Morris Taylor, he's not denying that people have biases or that he has his own biases. But what he's saying is that it doesn't have to matter. That as long as you treat everyone the same, that is professionally, and you interact with them professionally, you don't give them a reason to act like a jerk toward you, regardless of their bias. But he adds something else into this equation, too. And he says basically that's the idea of getting to know your community. The more you know people, the more you interact with them, the easier it is to be professional.
And if I had any power in this department, I would develop something that would ensure that officers take their time out to know their community and for the community to know them.
You know, what he's talking about sounds like a theme we've heard before over and over and over again, that In many respects, making, you know, building that trust between community and police is all about getting to know the community that you're policing.
Exactly. Letting them know that you are part of them. You experience the same things that they do living as a resident of St. Charles County. He's convinced it makes a difference. He said half of the numbers that he has in his phone are from women. It irritates his wife to no end. But he says that happens because when he goes out on a call and he treats people well, they're like, I need your number. I need to be able to call you and, you know, tell you what's going on. And he saves their number in his phone, too. His entire focus when he goes out on a call is to do the best he can to make better whatever is wrong. It's just all about really kind of helping the community and helping solve the situation. It's not just rolling up and clearing a call.
All right, so we've heard from two of the three officers you spoke with. Let's go to the third.
So the third gentleman I spoke to is Lieutenant Colonel Troy Doyle. He's with the St. Louis County Police Department. He's been there for 24 years, and he now oversees the Division of Patrol. So that's all of the officers that you see out in their cars driving around all those different units. He really wanted to change the community, too, but what his focus on was on the St. Louis County Police Department itself.
So what do you mean by that? Like rooting out corruption or?
Not so much corruption, but just sort of changing police culture and sort of how they interact with the communities where they are. When he came on in the early 1990s, he was one of 50 black officers on a sworn force of about 800. And he saw very quickly when he entered the force how difficult and how hard his job was going to be.
I remember when I came on in 1992. I was in another room doing a police report, and I remember one of the sergeants at the time having a discussion with another patrolman inside the station. Unbeknownst to him, he didn't know I was in an adjoining room, and I heard him make a comment about, you know, that there were good niggers and there was bad niggers, and it was at that point I realized, man, this thing is real, you know.
You know, that's just a really awful, heavy thing to hear as a rookie cop.
Absolutely.
You know, that had to have just been devastating for him to hear the officer in command say something like that.
And you have to remember, this was 20 years after Morris yeah. Taylor was hearing the N-word thrown around in casual conversation. So it's an indication of just how ingrained some of this stuff could be.
So he wanted to change that culture that he was in, which is an overwhelming task to say the least. I mean, what did he end up doing?
He didn't feel like he could do a whole lot at first, that he was just kind of there to fill a role as the black officer, just so they could say that the police force was diversified. But they didn't really want his input on how policing the African-American community can be different. He says it took him 16 years. He was about 37 when he finally felt like he could start speaking up.
Before, I mean, you joined the police department and you was just there. You was kind of like on an island on your own and you just had to figure things out. But now they have other African-American officers that they can go to for mentorship or just advice in general.
So it sounds like to me what he's really trying to get at is that it's not just about having more African-American cops on the beat. It's about having African-American officers in command positions that will ultimately filter down to changing some of the culture he encountered when he was a rookie cop.
Right. And it's a point that Doyle's boss, St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar, has made consistently. He basically says it's harder for him to control who joins the police force, that there's a lot of recruitment issues. They are making a push to recruit more minority officers. But Belmar says he can control who he promotes to higher positions. Obviously, the bigger the pool you have, the more black officers you bring on, the more chance there is to promote officers of color up to the higher ranks. Morris Taylor was also emphasizing the importance of command structure to me. His wasn't necessarily focused on the idea that they have to look like the officers they command, but they have to make sure that their officers are acting professionally. So modeling that behavior to the officers under their command.
All right, so what's your takeaway after talking to these three police officers?
You know, I think they're all kind of on to something. I had the chance to hear Sue Rahr speak at a conference in Chicago. She's the former sheriff of King County in Washington State. That's where Seattle's located. And her idea is that the most important thing for an officer is to be accepted as part of the pack. That's where you feel the safest. So conceivably, if you normalize the idea that everyone has to be treated professionally regardless of their race, if that's the message that's coming down from all of the command structures, then officers have to act that way to feel accepted in the pack. It's obviously much more complicated to execute than just outlining it here, but you could see how it would be a mechanism for departments to just maybe start changing how they behave.
Post-Ferguson, there has been a lot said about the lack of diversity in police departments.
And there is research that suggests, for example, that African-American residents will view police more favorably if there are African-American officers present.
But there's also research that suggests diversity alone won't root out any existing racial bias in policing.
Norman White is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at St. Louis University. He says for many police officers, this isn't a black-white thing. This is a blue thing.
When you are a police officer and you are running down an alley after somebody who could potentially be harmful to you, you need to know that the guy that's running behind you or beside you is blue. That you are going to get there and you both are going to be there ready to do what, the work that has to be done. It's of critical importance. As police officers, they have to be willing to stand by each other in ways that we will never understand. Because they at the beginning of their shifts, when they get ready to go to work at night, they are dealing with, you know, I want to come home tomorrow. Mm-hmm. At the end of these 8 hours, I want to be able to go home. You know, and if they don't know that they can depend on the people that they're with, that's not a certainty.
White spends a lot of time teaching students at St. Louis University who want to go into law enforcement.
They think that they are going to be able to make communities safer, that they can help with finding justice for victims. And they're all good of heart. You know, I teach delinquency and theories of crime, and I do a lot of stuff where I get students out in the community. And they interact with young people, and they come back and they feel like, you know, I want to be able to help kids to have a better life.
But White says knowing that he's setting his students up to stand at the intersection of generational poverty and systematic over-policing weighs on him.
I've struggled with this now. You know, I've been struggling with it because it's hard for me to meet with students who say they want to go into criminal justice and it's because they want to be police, to encourage that at this moment, because the nature of policing has changed in such a way that it makes the job, I would say, dehumanizing. It's dehumanizing not only to the people and the citizens that they encounter, but to them. It takes away their souls in many respects, that it's a difficult job made more difficult by the nature of what we've allowed to become. You know, so I talk about that I work in these communities, that I look at the intersection of people in communities, that we have allowed communities to be so burdened by almost our ambivalence, you know, that there is poverty that is deep. It destroys future and opportunity, and my students see that and they want to help, but then they go out and they begin to do the job and then things begin to change for them. You know, that they are, so now they're police and they're interacting in this world and they're seeing the reality, and the reality isn't what they saw on TV. You know, so it's not what you saw on Law and Order, mm-hmm. Or NCIS or CIA, you know, any of those shows. But they do it because they care about people. That's my understanding of them, that they do it because they believe in people and they believe that they can help them.
And that's something that we've heard from everyone on this show, the idea that connecting with people is at the heart of good policing.
White says a way to get back to that is to move away from a law enforcement model called broken windows policing. That's, you know, writing citations and stopping people for little stuff.
Little stuff that can land them in jail or in court. And that can mean navigating the criminal justice system without an attorney.
And that brings us to what we'll be talking about next time, Missouri's public defender system. We Live Here is produced by me, Emmanuel Berry.
And me, Tim Lloyd.
Shula Newman is our editor.
And Margie Fry-Vogel is the editor of St. Louis Public Radio. Our theme music was composed by Casey Morgan.
From St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.